paradox of liberty. Lest we forget, this chapter is about the great white Aryan Anglo-Saxon civilization's commitment to follow the sun, civilize the world, and help all the unfortunate savages find Jesus. One of those civilizing Anglos was, of course, Thomas Jefferson. In fact, the Smithsonian installed an exhibit dedicated to the greatest gentleman slave owner of the United States, entitled Slavery at Jefferson's Monticello, Paradox of Liberty. Author Leah Caldwell writes, after visiting the exhibit, "It doesn't bode well that if you enter the Jefferson exhibit not knowing what slavery was, you might come out thinking it was an intensive training program for highly skilled craftsmen." Nevertheless, Edward Rothstein's review in the New York Times is a classic example of the establishment's fourth estate protecting the status quo. Sit down, don't rock the boat. When he actually criticizes the exhibit for stating that Jefferson's Declaration of Independence did not extend life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness to African Americans, Native Americans, indentured servants, or women. Rothstein wrote that this pushed too far and that each of those cases needs different qualifications and examinations. They distract from the subject. In his autobiography, Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, the great social reformer remembers his first thoughts regarding his condition. In fact, his reflections on his own experiences offer an appropriate response to Jefferson's cheerleaders. Why am I a slave? Why are some people slaves and others masters? Was there ever a time when this was not so? How did the relation commence? Once engaged in the inquiry, I was not very long in finding out the true solutions of the matter. It was not color, but crime, not God, but man, that afforded the true explanation of the existence of slavery. Nor was I long in finding out another important truth, viz., what man can make, man can unmake. Here's another answer for those who like to contextualize about those masters who own, subjugate, and crush other human beings. It's never been considered okay to own another soul, unless, of course, you're modeling yourself after Satan. Remember, this wasn't during the lower Paleolithic period. It was during the so-called Age of Enlightenment. In his essay, Jefferson's Crime, Not Mitigated by the Standards of Time, journalism professor Robert Jensen frames Jefferson's blameworthiness. Certainly, Jefferson was familiar with Paine and the arguments against slavery. Certainly, Jefferson was aware of the existence of the idea that all humans had an equal claim to liberty, and the argument that Africans should be considered human in these matters. Certainly, there were many different ideas about the institution of slavery and racism in play at the time. So we're not judging Jefferson by the standards of our time when we point out the way in which he employed racism to justify the barbarism of slavery. We are acknowledging that others in Jefferson's time, including such notable figures as Paine, articulated anti-slavery and anti-racist principles at the same time that Jefferson was, in 1781, writing in his Notes on the State of Virginia about the natural inferiority of blacks. Discussing the night side of Jefferson's legacy in the radio documentary American Icons, Monticello, American artist Myra Kalman suggests, if you want to understand this country and what it means to be optimistic and tragic and wrong and courageous, you need to go to Monticello. Tragic and wrong, for sure. Monticello. Jefferson's neoclassical Virginia brick villa stoically perches above 5,000 acres of rolling green hills, his plantation once tended to by hundreds of African slaves. From Jefferson's divine resting place, vistas stretch forever, and the Blue Ridge Mountains loom to the west. Monticello is a popular tourist attraction where Jefferson's slavery component is, for the most part, whitewashed down the hillside where it flows to the Ravana River, which connects to the James River, past other sprawling Virginia estates that should rightly be categorized as America's colonial terrorist camps, also known as plantations. It's as if we've been erased, observed one African-American visitor. The iconic architectural element of Monticello is the dome structure that towers above all else on his celestial home. Many believe that dome to be nothing more than a stately aesthetic element. But factoring in Jefferson's obsession with African slaves, actual testimony from his slaves, and an architectural concept called panopticon, a darker, more deviant purpose emerges. Quote Bob Dylan, "All along the watchtower, princes kept the view, while all the women came and went, barefoot servants too." Lucia Cinder Stanton, Monticello's senior historian, envisions Monticello as a panopticon with Jefferson the all-seeing at the top. He could see everything that was going on. Jefferson's library contained a copy of a book called Panopticon that outlined a new and controversial prison design that called for circular cells surrounding a central watchtower. Inmates would be unaware if they were being observed. At least two former slaves talk about Jefferson with his telescope, watching enslaved people at work, Stanton reports. So this whole concept of surveillance from his central place on the apex of the mountain came through the oral tradition. He could see out, but nobody could see in. Equipped with his telescope, this warden in a powdered wig would gaze down from his heavenly dome, tracking his enslaved labor force on Mulberry Row or in the fields or wherever forced labor took them. The enlightened Jefferson kept meticulous records of almost everything associated with his life. Two subjects stand out, vegetables and slaves. Novelist and Professor Jamaica Kincaid, with regard to lettuce, cabbage, carrots, cucumbers, and peas. The garden book has details of the things he planted, the food he planted, but it looks as if it just falls magically at the table. So he'll say, peas were planted. 6 weeks later, peas appear at the table. There's no involvement of labor. There's no soil at all. It's as if it's eaten. It doesn't have any evil in it. But when it comes to the checklist of Negroes owned, as calculated by Jefferson, Kincaid says, the farm book, on the other hand, is all evil. Very similar to his book about peas, corn, beets, and other vegetables, the farm book is a painstaking record of the human beings Jefferson owned. Betty, Martin, Thenia, Critta, Sally, Johnny, Daniel, Molly, and so forth. Sinister? Yes. Evil? Absolutely. More fairy tales about America's founders? Of course. Here's how the Monticello website heralds the bullshit. Monticello was home not only to the Jefferson family, but to workers, black and white, enslaved and free. Workers? Jesus Christ. American bullshit runs deep. Jefferson historian Joseph Ellis underlines Monticello Tom's warped sense of his Teutonic responsibility. Jefferson argued that one of the reasons that he couldn't free his slaves was that once freed, the blacks would intermarry with the whites and would dilute the pure Anglo-Saxon race. Well, he's fathering children by Sally Hemings, and some of them look almost purely white, and again, you get a Faulknerian scene. He's eating dinner, and he's being served by a slave who happens to be his own son. You've been listening to excerpts from Murder, Incorporated, Empire, Genocide, Manifest Destiny, Dreaming of Empire, Book 1. It's written by Mumia Abu-Jamal and Stephen Vittoria.